Welcome to the Music Lobby. I'm Bill Huckberg, and on this episode, we'll go south of the border to check on what's happening in the Latin music industry. I'm joined by two fantastico Latin music biz lawyers, including Nico Urdanola, who was an artist in Colombia, signed to Universal Music Group before passing the bar and joining Shepard Mullin's entertainment law department. And John Baldivia of Rossi Baldivia, whose firm represents the very cream of the crop of today's Latin artists, like Carol G, Peso Pluma, and the record label of Bad Bunny. So check your visa and let's get jamming south of the border.
Your work deserves more than attention. It deserves protection. Rains is trusted by artists, producers, and creatives across the industry. With offices in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and beyond, we bring sharp legal thinking to litigation, business, real estate, and private client matters, protecting tomorrow and delivering today. We've got you. Rains.
I'm delighted to have two amazing music attorneys with thriving Latin American practices and top artists and companies that they represent. Hola, amigos. Soy gringo, but I love Latin music. And my wife is a Latina, by the way. But enough about me. Let's talk a bit about your personal journeys. Let's start off with that. Like, how'd you become a music attorney representing some of the biggest artists and companies in the Latin world and in the world, period? Because Latin music is now becoming really one of the biggest genres globally, and it raises legal issues and business issues that we'll be talking about. So, dígame, how did you get to where you are right now? Can we start with you, Nico? And also, first, tell us where you happen to be right now, because that's a really interesting background there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm in DC for the Hispanic National Bar Association annual conference. So yeah, that's a very, very cool organization that I've been involved for a couple of years now. So great. Yeah, so in terms of my journey, so I'm originally from Colombia. I went to law school there. I've always had, you know, a connection with my creative side. You know, I was a child actor in a regional network in my hometown of Cali. And then, you know, I was in every play of the school, and I always had that, but it was always, I always thought of that as a hobby, right? And then while I was in law school, we had, you know, bunch of friends. We started a band. It was just, you know, between friends, we were composing songs. And then, I never had a real interest in copyright or intellectual property really well at law school. And it's mainly because it's not, you know, a huge market, and it's not really something that's taught in law school. And so I never had that connection. But then, so we recorded a few demo songs, and they started to, you know, be shared through those, you know, sharing platforms, early 2000s, right? Like LimeWire, Kazaa. And, you know, one of those songs actually became what at the time was viral. And we ended up signing a deal with Universal Music. And, you know, it started becoming my profession. And I started, you know, kind of touring and, you know, recording. And you know, through that, I was kind of the one that had the closest relationship with the agreements, right? Like publishing agreements, the label agreements. And then that kind of told me that, you know, there's something there that's really interesting. And then after the first album, you know, that process had ended, and we were thinking about, you know, the second album, I kind of had second thoughts about whether I wanted to pursue that as my only career, being a musician. I always feel like, you know, if you're going to be a musician, that needs to be like the only thing that you're passionate about. And I had this other side that I wanted to explore. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, being an entertainment attorney, music attorney is going to be something that, you know, will allow me to combine those things, right? So I started in Colombia working for a, started first in a music label, and then transitioned into a big law firm there for like 6 years. Then came to the US in 2013, and first kind of worked for a few companies, Fox Sports, Disney, and then I moved to Sheppard Mullin, where I'm a partner right now in the entertainment practice. But I always kind of kept those connections in the industry, and it's a way for me to kind of keep that alive in a way. And I obviously have my my guitar on my side to help me through those stressful days, and to kind of help me move along.
Well, it's a great thing to have that perspective as an artist as well. And shout out to Bob Darwell at Sheppard Mullin, a legendary, great attorney and a friend for building this international practice. And he's got a lot of interest in Latin America. And so it's wonderful that you're on his team.
Yes, a shout out to Bob and to his vision. He's always had an international perspective and an interest in Latin America even before it was actually popular. Just to give you an example, our practice currently covers 12 languages and includes associates that are dually licensed in the US and in other countries like Colombia, Brazil, Nigeria, China, and Lebanon.
So John, can you give us a bit of your personal journey?
Yeah, sure. Although my personal journey isn't quite as interesting as Nico's, but I've had a passion in music growing up. Played in band, did choir for a lot of my youth. And when I had left or graduated from college to move out to Los Angeles, I was working at a number of different independent and major label distributors for the first part of my career. Was at Universal Music while I was studying law school at Southwestern during the evening program, and transitioned into law from there. And so my first job as a lawyer was doing copyright litigation, which then I transitioned to doing general litigation and music contracts at Pierce Law Group, which was run by the late David Pierce. And then from there, moved over to the firm that I'm at now, Rossi Valdivia Klein Fine and Spector, where I'm a partner, and most of our businesses focus on Latin music and entertainment.
Well, can we mention any of the clients that you guys are working with? Because they literally are the top of the top in Latin music. Can I mention them?
Sure, Nico, want to go first, or?
No,
Yeah,
go
I
ahead.
mean Peso Pluma and the
Yeah,
company.
so our firm works with Peso Pluma, with Double P, with Remus, which with Carol G, Rancho
And
Mille.
just for those who don't know, Remus is the company that Bad Bunny, I believe it's his company or he's a partner in it.
Right. Danny Ocean, Elena Rose, Rich Music. Sky Rompiendo, we've got Mag who produces for Bunny. We represent a number of high-level executives in the Latin space.
Okay, so that means we can't talk about Latin music anymore because you represent them all. So you can just we'll just you can just nod or do this, but you won't be talking anymore during this conversation because you represent too many amazing A-list talent and their companies. Anyway,
Well, yeah.
all right. So we'll continue here. Did you want to start off? We were talking about sort of deals like cross border music transactions and especially like kind of the deals. Okay, I've heard some compare the Latin music deals, kind of maybe not true today, but just a few years ago, as being so exploitive, so terrible that they're sort of analogous to the rock and roll deals from the 50s and 60s. I mean, you're talking about really low royalties, just bad deals. Even the Beatles had a ridiculously bad initial record deal, as told to me by Bruce Gröckel, a great music lawyer who's represented Ringo for many years. And it's also written about quite a bit about what a horrible deal that was. So back in the 60s and 50s, And that the Latin, what's the Latin music? Is that a good, a fair analogy in any way? Is the Latin deal of today sort of back in the Stone Age in terms of comparison to like a US deal?
In my experience, I don't think it's as bad as you would think. I think that, just kind of the access to information that we have right now, right? It's so easy to just Google, standard terms of a recording agreement or a publisher agreement. That I think, while there might be still differences and there might still be a lot of 360 agreements in place that kind of, may be more detrimental to the artists than the US deals might be, but I wouldn't say that they're, substantially and materially different, but I don't know.
I would echo that, and I think that once you're talking about major label talent and artists of that caliber, you're really talking about people who are represented by US attorneys. And so just by virtue of that, there's going to be a push towards getting their deals structured in a way that's more modern. Now, when you're not talking about doing deals with the majors, and you're talking about, maybe budding talent or talent that hasn't been discovered, there's a lot more of the lack of sophistication, and that's where you see a lot of these predatory deals. I think of it more as the kind of deals that you would see happen in like rap music in like the 80s, 90s. Where managers are really taking ownership over rights and that kind of stuff. You see that happen now and then, but I think Nico is right in that there is a lot of information available, and it's you're seeing less of it, but it's still there, only to the extent that you're dealing with people who just haven't been exposed to it before.
So you see a trend in this in the US and the UK of artists not wanting to sign with major labels. Is that true in Latin America too? That they, I mean, certainly with Bad Bunny, I mean, he's got his own company and all that, but in general, is it better to get a deal for a budding talent with a major in either at a regional office in Colombia or wherever, or in the US, or to go sort of do an indie deal?
No, I still think that the major labels play a very big role in the industry and breaking talent. They might not be getting them at the ground level as much, but when it comes to bringing them up to the next caliber tier of stars, I think the majors are still heavily involved in that process. It's not often that you get somebody like a Bad Bunny or Peso Pluma who can hit that level without going through a major label, because what's partly required to hit that level of success is having a team that can compete at that same level. And if you don't have that kind of team around you, it's really hard to reach that level of success.
Team, but you can have a like a just a distribution deal. Well, we can get to that a little later. But Nico, so you in your past life as an artist, you were signed to UMG out of the regional Columbia office, or was it out of the U.S.? Okay.
No, the local office, yes.
And any thoughts about that today? Would that be sort of is that the only option if you're an up and coming artist in Colombia, or can you sign directly with like the major in a US deal?
I think everything is possible, obviously, and it will depend on the type of artist and the type of music that they're doing. But I think the typical trajectory is first going to the local office, then going to the regional office, which could be Mexico or it could be, Miami, US, and then eventually hitting like the major, US affiliate, right? I remember in our case, it was UMG for Latin America, and we had remember they had a deal with Machete, which was a label, and they were doing the distribution in the US. Our music was, very folk-like. So it was it's a genre called tropipop, pop, which kind of it's a fusion between pop rock and vallenato, which is a very folk genre, Colombian genre, which with accordions and all that. So yeah, I remember the first time when we came here to the US and we were having a discussion with the head of the publisher, and he was just listening to the music and he was just telling us, yeah, this is too folky for the US. You might want to consider, removing the accordion.
Yeah, but
So
he was wrong, wasn't he? And you're so humble. I mean, you're aren't you a Latin Grammy nominee? And didn't your song get picked up by Carlos Vives, like one of the all-time great Colombian artists?
yeah, so the band, and it was the band was nominated for their second album right after I left. And then after Carlos Vives did a remix of a song that we composed called El Parrandero. He did a remix 2 years ago. And then the song was nominated to the Latin Grammys. And as a composer, I was also nominated. But then something very interesting happened, which was the category did not allow for songs to be remixes. It had to be original. So it was actually announced. It was formally announced. It was one of the songs that was, nominated. We received, the nomination email, everything. And then they had to basically take it down for the ceremony. So I don't know if that's probably one of the few occasions where that has happened. So I continue to think and say that I was in fact nominated, even if it was eventually denominated.
Oh boy, well, that's amazing. But now, in terms of distributors, like if you're pretty established and you've got a team, you were talking, John, about like how important the team is, and you've got a great team yourself, you're an artist. Do you want a major label deal, or do you want more of a deal with just a distributor, like The Orchard, for example? I've heard people talk about how established they are, how important Latin America is, and they seem to really, and they're just a distributor. So they're you're not if you're an artist. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between just doing a distribution deal and doing a full-on like label deal, you guys?
Well, yeah, I mean, when you're talking about distribution, what you're really talking about is handling pretty much, the vast majority of the work other than getting the music up to the DSPs. So you're having your own team run all the marketing, you're having your own team run all the A&R for the project or for the label. And the distributor takes their cut, and maybe they've got some investment by offering in advance, but largely that's it. And then you're responsible for the rest, versus when you have like a recording deal or even a license deal, you've got a lot more support from the label, where they're using their teams to do the marketing or lead with artist development or that kind of initiative. And it really depends on where you are at the state of your career or the state of your development as a label, to determine what it is that you actually need, what kind of support you need.
And the resources, right? I think the resources are also a key element, right? Like you have a label that has not only like the individuals and the know-how and the human resources, but they have the funds also to invest, right? Whereas an artist, depending on their level, they might not have that, right? Like they might have an investor and they kind of do that through that. But as you were pointing out earlier, John, it's very rare that that happens. It's very rare that an emerging artist will have a team that has sufficient level of sophistication and that has sufficient level of know-how in the industry and the resources to actually make it work.
Right. And just to further emphasize that, when you're talking about going with one of the major labels, and especially with Latin music, you really need a team that can support a global release, right? That means somebody that can help with the launch, when it's happening in Australia, then when it's happening, as the time zones are kind of shifting over to the next day, happening in Europe, and then LATAM, and then North America, to have a team that'll coordinate that entire process. It's as an independent, you're rarely going to have, somebody re manning all those separate territories without a large team.
And one huge difference between doing a label deal with all those label services and A&R and all of that versus doing a straight up deal like with it just distribution is that with distribution, it's just a percentage deal. They take maybe a 20% cut or some give or take something like that. Whereas with a typical label deal, full on label deal, you're actually essentially giving them your copyrights, selling them, or it's a work for hire. And so if you have a if you do that, you may regret it, particularly when in, and we're going to talk more about the laws of termination rights and things like that. Where in the United States, you do have termination rights, even if you sign a deal, sign everything away, including the house and the car and everything. If you sign everything away, it doesn't matter. You get a termination right after a certain number of years. Latin American countries don't have that, to my knowledge. So doing a distro deal is a good idea. And the Orchard, I don't want to mention any names, but I think that some of your clients and some other big clients are using the Orchard, and they're owned by Sony now. They were started by my friend Scott Cohen and Richard Goddard, founders of it. But it seems to be pretty seriously entrenched in Latin America. Would anyone agree with that, or want to
They've
say?
got a strong presence in Latin America for sure. There are some there, there are other distributors that are trying to make their waves into it. A lot of the majors have their own independents that are doing more like distribution type services that are, focused on Latin America. But Orchard is certainly one of the names to pay attention to.
Okay, great. Great. I'm sure I'll get hate mail from other distributors that are telling me that why didn't I mention them? But I do have some I've heard a lot of good things about the Orchard. But nonetheless, anything else to talk about on this particular thing about deals in south of the border, let's say, or should we move on? We can move on to another topic. Okay.
Well, I think that there, and this is a discussion I've had with other attorneys in the past, this concept of whether or not to sign a deal in the US versus signing deals locally, right? In like a, with like the major affiliate in Colombia or something like that. Where I think generally it's pretty known that if you do a deal in the US, you're going to have a bigger budget to play with. The downside being that you kind of fall lower down the ladder in terms of priority, versus if you're with your local affiliate major label, they've got more of an emphasis of working on your project, just, less funds to play with.
Okay. What about the informality part of it? Are there deals that are just more handshake deals, or just really like you hear horror stories about, people become successful and then they want to sell their catalog and they did some producer deal where they gave all their rights away, and it was just a terrible deal or a handshake deal. Is there more of that in Latin America where it's just not papered or papered properly, and there wasn't a U.S. lawyer involved necessarily? You seeing that?
Not at the high level,
Okay.
but
But yeah, I would say I'm still seeing it, and it becomes more common when dealing with music catalogs, right? And in those circumstances, you will have to when you go deep into chain of title. You see situations in which there are either no agreements or the agreements are definitely not what you would expect. And I think it's important to clarify here that we're and that's something even within the music industry, right? Like we this industry is relatively informal compared to other industries, right? Like on the TV and film side, all agreements have to be signed, and if you're engaging a talent, you're engaging it through a long form. If, at least if you're talking about the studios, right? Here, if you're talking about even major labels, most of the deals, or at least many deals, side artist deals, guest artist deals are basically via email, right? Sync licenses are granted via email all the time, right? So it's by itself an informal industry. And then when you go to Latin America, obviously, and it has to do, obviously, like the level of sophistication has to do with the size of the industry, right? And you know, it's still in development. I think it's definitely getting better. And you can see, I remember at my time when I graduated, there was really no one doing entertainment law, right? Now you have a lot of people doing entertainment law. There are a lot of, obviously, the industry has grown. There are more resources, and then obviously there's more sophistication now.
Okay, great. So we don't have to say that you need a U.S. attorney or a U.K. attorney. There are attorneys in Latin America that are quite qualified to handle this and experienced. Yeah. Okay. So let's just move to another cross-border issue, which is visa issues. And I'm just going to queue this one up. It's mostly a Mexican thing, but you have a couple of stories that have been in the news. One was back in May with an artist, a Mexican norteño artist named Julion Alvarez, big Mexican artist. Okay, he had a sold-out show at a 50,000 seat stadium in Texas. The day before he was coming in, his visa was revoked. Why? Because they alleged that he had some connection to a cartel, but it wasn't clear. And so it was just, but the day before, no notice. And that happened. Another story in April, around the same time, and this is when things were really ramping up with ICE. They're still really going on with that, a lot going on with that now. But this was in April, a band called, and so this Julion Alvarez had some Narcoritos, okay, that he, which are songs, Mexican songs, that they're sort of stories that kind of glorify drug dealers. So this other band called Los Alegres del Barranco, I guess the happy people from the ravine or something. What does that translate as? But they're in a real ravine now because they're another norteño band. They were actually banned from entry into the U.S. by the State Department. But before that, they came under criminal investigation in Mexico by Claudia Sheinbaum's administration because they had these shows and they had behind the stage this big picture of El Menche, who's the leader of the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, one of the most powerful and violent criminal organizations in Mexico, during the show. And they're singing songs about how great he is. So there was a criminal investigation against him, about them, and but they settled it with the Sheinbaum government by, guess what? Putting out an anti-Narcorito song against those narco cartels, and also doing some public service and education and all this stuff. So they had that removed, and they're in the good graces of the Mexican government, but the U.S. State Department is still not letting them in. They're not doing any shows. I checked to see, and that they're not doing any shows here. So that's a thing. So where I'm going with this is I want to ask you if you're dealing with Mexican artists or any Latin artists, really. This is a problem. I mean, and it's also a problem that's been in the rap world, right? With the Young Thug trial and others where the rap lyrics are used as evidence of crime. So it gets down to a question of of free and all of that. Can we talk about that, like music, particularly, this thing about, Los Alegres del Barranco being forced to come out with an anti-narcorrido, and you seeing that with your artists, being, wanting to maybe tone it down a little bit in terms of some of their lyrics, things like that, to avoid these kinds of problems.
I haven't. I don't know much about the specific examples that you brought up. I will say generally that I've seen instances, whether dealing with label waivers. The Latin music industry is very collaborative, and so there's artists constantly releasing collaborations with other artists, right? And what I've seen particularly recently is that sometimes the artists will change their mind about whether or not to release a song or whether or not to perform a certain song live because he or she isn't a US resident or, you know, doesn't the visa status isn't cleared or is expiring and they don't want to do anything to disrupt that. And so, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, kind of curbing speech just because of the impact that it might have on their visa status. I've seen that happening more so now than years past.
No, and in years past, I mean, you had like NWA with Dope Man and F the Police, and you had like the Notorious B.I.G. with 10 Crack Commandments, how-to guide for drug dealing. You had, and you had like, Arlo Guthrie coming into Los Angeles with a bringing in a couple of keys, and Eric Clapton and J.J. Cale, Cocaine. You had the Outlaws and Austin, Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash writing these outlaw songs. What's the difference? Is that like a double standard here that they well, I guess you can't deport them. Maybe that's
I think that, I mean, at least from that respect, that ends up being what it is. You know, I think it's a, you know, certain artists that are not US citizens or don't have legal status to come visit. They just, you know, US is such a big market in terms of the music industry, they don't want to disrupt that.
Yeah, it's not worth the risk, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, the US is, I would say, the biggest market. Let's talk a little bit about Bad Bunny's boycott of the United States for his latest tour and sort of what the reasoning is behind that. Has he been making comments about that recently?
Yeah, sure. So it publicly came out that Bad Bunny had decided not to tour, at least within the United States, for fear that ICE would be waiting outside of his concerts and deporting people as they would attend the concert. It's certainly an interesting point to be made. With everything that's going on with the mass deportations and everything, I think there's also something to be said as far as practice when it comes to how you're negotiating contracts for performing artists, especially in the Latin space, because now all of a sudden we have to think about whether or not force majeure language is encompassing ICE raids at concerts. For example, force majeure language would have something that includes government action, and it becomes a question of whether or not you have to specify whether mass deportations happening at a concert or the threat of mass deportations happening at the concert would constitute as a force majeure event that allows the artist to cancel after an agreement has been entered.
No,
So
that's
it's certainly changed the way that we've looked at that provision, and the way that we've approached it with our talent, especially on a moving forward basis, because, you know, we don't know when this practice is going to end.
very good point. Yeah. Now, Bad Bunny recently announced, or it was announced. I don't know if he announced it that he's going to be performing at the Super Bowl halftime show in February. How does that square with his boycott of the US market for his latest tour? Is it after the tour?
I mean, if you're talking just purely from the perspective of what his reasoning was, I don't think that him performing for the Super Bowl changes that very much because, you know, the people who are attending the Super Bowl aren't necessarily, you know, large populations of undocumented immigrants the way that it might be with his own you know, performances. But, you know, certainly the audience is interested in where he performs. I just don't think that the Super Bowl is one of those that's at risk for, you know, ICE showing up and waiting outside the gates.
Absolutely. Now, what else is going on in terms of artists? south of the border, who are being targeted by State Department or Justice Department regarding their cartel, regarding their connections with potential connections or alleged connections with drug cartels. Is there some development there?
Well, what's interesting is that, I've come across instances where I've heard that immigration status is being heavily affected by who and a Latin artist, particularly with regional Mexican content, who they performed for in the past. For example, if an artist has performed for a narco trafficker, either recently or even years prior, my understanding is that as soon as the current administration gets wind of it, they're designating people as terrorists, the artists, whether or not they've actually participated in the activities or not.
And whether or not they even knew who was hiring them,
I mean, that's my understanding. I don't know for certain how far it goes, but from what I heard, whether it's just a matter of whether they've done business with them in the past, right? It doesn't sound like there's any mens rea component involved with it. So whether you intended to or not, with your knowledge, I think it's literally as far as if they've ever performed for someone who is or is a known trafficker, it's affected their status.
interesting. Let me ask you about how K-pop relates to the the Spanish language pop music world. And some would argue that the K-pop kind of busted the doors down in terms of non-English language speaking artists becoming universal worldwide superstars, including in the US market, which I would say maybe 10 years ago it would be unheard of for a non-English language artist to break through, I mean, as number one on the charts across the board. I mean, is it the case that that Spanish language pop music is on the rise right now? And also one other thing, if I could just throw it in here, is that the label HYBE is opening up a record, looks like a music company in Mexico. And what do you know about that or make of that? HYBE
Well,
is the company behind BTS and really maybe the most prolific K-pop music company.
I mean, 2 points. I can't go as far as agreeing with you that K-pop opened the doors for Latin music. I mean, Latin music's been popular in the US for decades. You could even look as recently as any songs by Selena or Jenny Rivera or even Song Despacito or Daddy Yankee's Gasolina. Those were all global hits. And that was well before K-pop's made its strong push here in the United States. What I think it is more attributable to is the impact of streaming and how it's opened up a global market. Because now it's allowing, primarily English speaking US based audience to tap into music that's not necessarily in the English language, like K-pop or like Latin music, like reggaeton or regional Mexican music, and getting to experience more of that genre and just being more exposed to it because of the prevalence of streaming and the way that it's opened doors for global markets. I don't think it's limited to just Latin or just K-pop. I mean, we could even say the same about the way that African music has made an impact. The way that J-pop has spread around, the way that other non-English speaking genres have made noise on a global scale.
Great. That's terrific insight. In any event, Free speech. Yeah, I mean, and then at the same time, you have it's not all that fair necessarily when you have Trump pardoning Lil Wayne, Kodak Black, and Young Boy Never Broke Again, who were jailed on weapons charges and have songs about drug trafficking and so forth. It's not a fair world, I guess you would say. Maybe we can just kind of leave it at that. But are you seeing some Latin artists that are just sort of saying, let's just lay low on this song for now and not put that out? Are you also vetting some of those lyrics and saying, hey, I don't know if this is going to go over?
I mean, as legal, we don't really play a part in the creative process.
Yeah. Okay.
But when they, when they're the ones that are telling us, you know what, we don't want this coming out, then, we
Oh, so
guess.
they're self-censoring, so to speak.
So, yeah, a lot of times, or it's another artist saying, hey, we'd rather that not come out, or, wherever the instruction is coming from, there is it's people are paying attention to it.
Yeah, it's definitely becoming a thing.
Are you seeing any like retribution from other companies, like notably like Brazil or anything, in retaliation? Not retribution, but sort of retaliation against, giving a hard time to, say, any of that to U.S. nationals who are traveling into places like Brazil or other countries as
Well,
a tour.
I've seen, with artists that are traveling to Brazil that might have American citizens as part of the tour company. There's certainly different treatment as far as how they view U.S. citizens coming into the country versus other Latin American countries, citizens of other Latin American countries that are coming to Brazil, in that there's a little more heightened regulation when they're talking about U.S. citizens going to Brazil. And I can only presume that it's, in part because of how U.S. might be treating Brazil politically, maybe, but I have noticed that happen.
Yeah, no, that has been a reality. It's not maybe it's becoming a little bit more strict lately, but that has been like a general rule in Brazil. They do have this reciprocity with other countries that require visas from them. So, that has been the case for a while. It might be that, they're adding additional requirements, but
I think there was a recent law change in Brazil that it had impacted it. Maybe it's specific U.S., maybe it's not, but I did hear that there were some recent changes in the law in Brazil with regards to immigration.
So let's talk about streaming. Okay, streaming, it's all, very transparent nowadays. I mean, so it's like you can't th there's no, questions about, how many rec physical records were sold, and it seems to be also good in that way because it's pretty transparent and also not subject so much to piracy, right? With the physical records, you would have just tons and tons of piracy, to my knowledge. Maybe I'm wrong, but in Mexico, certainly. I was traveling with Guns N' Roses actually at one point with them, representing one of them at that time. And in the van going to a show in Mexico City at an arena, drive about almost a mile. Going toward the arena, there were just people selling bootleg merchandise and stuff all the way there. And the band members and the entourage were just looking and saying, and managers, whatever, oh, that one looks pretty good. That's actually looks legit. Gee, that shirt, oh, that guy's got a good knockoff, because it's sort of futile. I mean, it's a multi-billion dollar business, the piracy. But getting back to the actual records, streaming would seem to me to be a positive thing because it is sort of transparent. And some can we talk about, like, in particularly in Latin America, is streaming, has it been a good thing there? What are the bigger ones? Is Spotify, Apple Music, is Deezer there, YouTube? What are the big ones? And can you sort of talk about that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, YouTube probably continues to be the biggest player. You were mentioning Deezer. I think they were probably one of the earlier players in that market. But yeah, all of those are growing and are becoming more relevant. And I think in terms of what this, yeah, it's definitely a reality that streaming platforms are the revenue is definitely increasing, and they are something that the those markets require. I'm not sure that it would still kind of be at a point where the revenues from streaming are kind of compensating for the lack of sales of physical CDs or other physical
And
media.
that is that because because you can't with streaming, you can buy just one song in, many times, not always, but with in the old days, you might only have to buy the whole album, and that's part of it. Is that
I
part
think
of it?
that would be one of the arguments, and also I think we need to consider that the payments that are made by the streaming platforms in Latin America are not the same as and in general, right? Like this is the biggest market, and payments that are made in the US are obviously higher, right? So and substantially higher, right? So I think that difference makes it harder for the those revenues to sustain the whole industry in the region.
So can you talk a little bit about, like, for instance, YouTube, I think is dominating in the streaming world for music everywhere. Can you talk a little bit about it? I know you looked into it, like kind of how the rates are different with YouTube in different territories.
Yeah, I was looking at a chart where the CPM for every 1,000 views on
Can you
YouTube.
say what CPM is for people who don't know?
Yes,
It's
so
the thousand. It's a per thousand, right?
yeah.
Views, basically.
Correct. So that was basically, more than $8 versus in Colombia where it was, less than $1, like 67 cents or something. So that you can see how that, and obviously that's tied to revenues, right? Like obviously advertisers are paying more money for their ads in the US than they would pay in other regions. So I think that's where the difference comes into play as well.
Also, with streamers and like Spotify, Apple, I guess Deezer also was one of the first. Was Deezer one of the first in Latin America? I thought you mentioned.
Yeah, I believe it was definitely one of
Well, so I know, like, with many of them, they will charge 30% off the top. So 30% is the fee that goes to the DSP, which is the digital service provider, which is Spotify, Apple, Deezer, YouTube, TikTok, whatever. I don't know about TikTok, but and full disclosure, they're a client, so I shouldn't be talking about them. But certainly with Spotify, Apple Music, it's a 30% fee off the top. Is there in Latin America, do you happen to know if there are any other fees that are tacked on that might be specific to the region?
I think that when you're talking about the economics of streaming and different territories, just in general, depending on what kind of deal you have with your label, you sometimes have to be mindful of whether or not there's intercompany fees, right? If revenue is generated in one territory, then that revenue then has to be funneled into the US before it gets accounted to the artist. Some record deals will provide that there's some kind of deduction that happens with that transfer. And not to say that the practice is still the general guideline now, but it still happens a lot. So what you're really trying to do is you're trying to get deals that are calculated at source. A lot of times you get it, but a lot of times you still don't.
Okay. Let's just jump over the copyright thing. We were going to talk about that next, but go over it. We'll get back to it. But to the PROs, and the PRO is a performing rights organization. Some people know about it here in the States. It's ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, and there are some others, and Global Music Rights, and which our firm represents. So I can't, not full disclosure there. But CSAC BMI, ASCAP, are performing rights organizations. They collect for music played on radio, TV, concert halls, restaurants as background music. And it's paid to music publishers and songwriters. You also have neighboring rights, which is the same thing, but it's paid to labels and artists. And we don't need to go too deeply into that. But I want to talk about the PROs. So you have, and also how much money are we talking about? So there's an organization called SISAC that says that came out with a report just in May, I believe, that said there's about 12 billion in collections worldwide on this, and they didn't break it down for Latin America, but that's a substantial amount of money that we're talking about here. That's CISAC, CISAC, not to be confused with CSAC, which is the Performing Rights Organization, and not to be confused with Sissy Spacek, who's a great actress, by the way. So we are talking now about a lot of alphabet soup. There's a lot of these, every country has one, I think. At least one. Brazil has five performing rights organizations that collect for that. It's a complicated area. There was some corruption several years ago in Spain. People would talk about these lavish, incredible headquarters for this place, and there was a person there who actually ended up being convicted and going to jail for using money. They using money that should have gone to artists for lavish lifestyle stuff. There's a thing called the black box that they talk about, which is money that they just don't know who it goes to. Like there was a case in France at one point where they had an artist named E. John. They didn't know who E. John was. Elton John? No, they didn't know. So it goes in the black box and eventually gets distributed locally. So it's those kind of things. I don't suspect that it's mostly corruption issues that are going on now, because I think that was cracked down on pretty heavily, and they're better now. But there are issues, aren't there, with PROs in terms of them paying. How do those deals work? If you're an artist and you're a songwriter, how would you? And you're based in Colombia, say, or Mexico or Argentina, are you going to want to do a deal with a local PRO or like a worldwide deal with, because some of like ASCAP and BMI or CSAC or PRS in the UK to collect all around the world? Can you guys talk about the PROs in Latin America and how that might be different than everywhere else in the world?
Sure. I mean, there's when you're a songwriter that's based in a a country outside the U.S., there's always going to be this aspect of the timing issue with respect to the payment of your performance royalties. What writers will sometimes do, if they're able to with their local PRO, is sign a deal with their local PRO. Let's say you're a songwriter from Argentina and you sign up with SEDAI, right, which is the PRO over there. You sign, if they allow it, that you can sign a deal with them just to collect performance royalties within Argentina, and then do a deal with maybe ASCAP or BMI or CSAC to do the rest of the world outside of Argentina. That way, you're getting royalties from public performance in Argentina directly. And then every other territory, you're not getting that money until that money's already been accounted to the PRO in the US. And as far as the timing, what happens is when, the performing rights organizations are gonna report to you in arrears to some degree, all the
In other words, like what, 8 or 9 months or so?
time. The agreement says one thing, in practice it ends up being, something more. But whatever it is, let's say that you have, a record that's doing really well in Colombia, right? But you're with ASCAP or BMI. The PRO in Colombia is going to collect, for whatever that accounting period is, and then they'll account it to your PRO in the US, which, however long that takes. Plus, then now you have to wait for that money to get accounted to you, whenever they end up accounting to you for the period that they received it, because from, as far as an earnings standpoint, it's not calculated as far as your statements are concerned. It's not calculated when the public performance occurred in Colombia. It's counted from the date that the revenue actually was received in the United States. So if let's say it was performing well at the end, at in the fourth quarter of 24, but it doesn't hit the accounts in the US until September of 25, those don't show up to your statements until they show up as Q3 earnings for September 25, which you won't get paid until March of 26.
So there's
And
like
not
an
only
initial.
that,
so go ahead, Bill.
no, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that not only that portion, which obviously is extremely relevant, but the fact that you're gonna get there's gonna be a charge as well, right? Like the Colombian PRO cycle, let's say, right, is gonna take a cut for their collection services, right? And then in addition to that, that may be also subject to withholding taxes, right? So that's gonna take another chunk of the money that is gonna be sent to the US PRO. So, and vice versa, right? So I agree. I think the ideal scenario is if the artist is relevant in a specific country, right, to kind of handle that relationship with the PRO locally and then have a US-based PRO for the rest of the world, that could work. But as you were pointing out, John, sometimes PROs are not open to that, right? So I think I was telling you the other day that I wanted to do that with Psycho, and they didn't allow me to do
Okay,
it
where is
or
Psycho?
Colombia, in Colombia.
Colombia.
So it's
Okay.
all or nothing basically, right? So sometimes they'll be a little bit more difficult. But yeah, I mean, all the big
Well, that's
artists
not very
aren't able to
nice,
do
because
it.
that's not very nice. And I mean, ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, and PRS in the UK are aggressively looking for to handle the rest of the world. For instance, there's a very big US artist that I won't name, who's keeping one of those US PROs just for the US and then using PRS in the UK for the rest of the world. But what you're saying is, in some Latin countries, they won't let you do that. It's
Yeah,
like you're either.
it could happen. I mean, I know that they have allowed it for other artists. I know that for a fact. But I, in my specific case, it might be the situation of other songwriters. And I think the other very important difference that I think, and you touched on it when you were talking about neighboring rights, but I think it's really important for people to understand is that in the U.S., you have public performance over, the musical works, but then you have very limited royalties on the sound recordings, right? So you basically only have Sound Exchange, right, collecting from the digital performance of non-interactive platforms, right? Like basically digital radio stations. Whereas in most of Latin American countries, and I would say all of them, because they follow the civil law system where you have the rights of authors and then the neighboring rights, you are collecting for exactly the same, like almost all public performance, exactly in the same terms, right? So you have, so again, the example in Colombia, right? You have Psycho for the musical work piece, right? For writers and composers and publishers, and then you have Asimpro for public performance, same radio stations, TV stations, and any other type of public performance through that
Well, let me
other.
just, if I could just break that down a bit for a
Yeah.
second, is neighboring rights. Okay, so we're the PROs that we're talking about are collecting money that goes from the radio broadcasts and from the live shows and all of that, that goes to the songwriter and to the publisher, only that side of it. Okay, and then the neighboring rights, and they call it neighboring rights because it's not quite copyright, but it's a close neighbor of it. And it was, I believe, through the Rome Convention. And the US is not a signatory to that anyway. Not go too far down in the weeds there, but it is not for the songwriter, it's for the artist and for the label. So, for example, like Frank
And
Sinatra
producers.
and the producers too. Yeah, so Frank Sinatra didn't write his songs, but he had a big hit called Night and Day that Cole Porter wrote. So Cole Porter and his publisher get or his estate get the PRO money, or the performance income, on the publishing side, the song side, and then Frank Sinatra, the label, get the neighboring rights income in some of those places for that. And there's also record royalties too. It's complicated business. Don't try it at home on your own. But go back to what you were saying, and you were talking about the different that it's the same thing. It's going to be a live show, it's going to be a broadcast, and it's going to generate these two kinds of royalties, the performance royalty and the neighboring rights royalty. And
That's
you
correct.
also, you know.
No, I was just going to say that it's not necessarily like applied as like consistently in all countries. So again, my understanding is that in Mexico, for instance, they've been having a hard time actually. The neighboring rights bureaus, they don't collect everything, right? I believe radio and TV, they've had a hard time collecting those. So it's not necessarily consistent throughout all countries in Latin America. I know Colombia is very good at it, and it's been doing it for a very long time. But it's not necessarily consistent. They might have the right to do it from a legal
Right.
perspective, but I'm not sure that they've been able to actually collect in all countries.
Now, you mentioned before, like withhold. So overall, what we're talking about is long time before you're going to get paid. I mean, because the regional place is going to take forever, maybe 6, 9 months to get the money, and they're holding the money, and then it goes to, if you have a deal with BMI or ASCAP or CSAC, it's going to go there, and it might sit for several months there. And guess what? I think in a lot of cases, that money is collecting interest for those organizations. That's not going to the artist in some cases, and it's a long wait. Some PRS, the UK one, is very aggressive, and they're claiming that it's like 3 or 4 months versus 8 or 9 months. But it's different for different places. But you were talking about withholding. Are you talking about tax withholdings? We're not going to get into a big tax discussion here, but what kind of withholdings were you meaning when you mentioned?
Yeah, with taxes
Okay, so
on the taxes side.
that's a whole big discussion, and we're not going to get into it, but I will give a shout out to Steve Felsenthal at my firm, who I asked some questions about it here, and it's complicated, folks. You got to look at tax treaties for each country. And so, for instance, if you have outbound money coming from the US, royalties to a Germany, to a German, there's no withholding on royalties. If it's Puerto Rico has its own tax regime, according to Steve Felsenthal, there would be a withholding on the royalties. So it's
And it
complicated.
can be very substantial. I'm telling you, like Colombia's withholding tax, I mean, and it's subject to a lot of different rules and conditions, but it can go as high as 30%. So that can be a huge impact. One thing I wanted to mention that I think it's important is for anyone doing business with Latin American artists or in Latin America, I think it's very important to have like a network of local attorneys, because as we've been kind of discussing, it is really important to be able to have the ability to call someone or ask someone when things like this come up, right? You want to be able to have that kind of networking place, because you're definitely not going to be able to understand everything, and there's so many nuances in each country.
Absolutely.
And understanding that, I think it's very important.
And your firm, Sheppard Mullin, has offices in Latin America too?
No, we don't have offices, but yeah, we basically built
You do. Out of
yeah.
Miami, and you work out of Miami, right?
I
Do you?
do. I do. So I work for the LA Century City office, but I am remote, and I've been remote since
So one
2020.
yeah, one thing I would love you guys to comment on is this idea of Spanish language music not only being, huge in Latin America, but artists like Bad Bunny, Peso Pluma, Karol G are among the biggest artists in the world right now, and they're singing in Spanish. Now, you would never have imagined something like that 10 years ago, even maybe 5 years ago. Well, you had Korean K-pop music that kind of broke the barrier, where you would have people, huge songs that were in a language that no most people over here didn't understand, but it was still a huge hit. And it sort of gets into some geopolitics, maybe, possibly, or soft power. You go back to, without Going too deep into this, but go back to the second after the Second World War, when the U.S. really became the biggest superpower. You had, Frank Sinatra, the Andrew Sisters and stuff played everywhere. And then that just continued, and you had Michael Jackson anywhere you went in the world, you would hear that, or for that matter, Bob Marley, but in English, and U.S. and then, the U.K. When the Beatles came along, it became a bigger thing. But it was sort of a hegemony of Anglo. It was the English language, except with a few very, very few anomalies, was what you listened to in pop music, no matter where you were, no matter what language they spoke here. So this thing about Spanish language music, like Bad Bunny and Peso Pluma and Karol G and some Shakira and Carlos Vives and others, being huge everywhere. What do you guys think is going on there? I mean, is that a shift of magnitude that we've not seen before?
I mean, I think it's more a testament to
Or
just
am I
how
getting too excited here? I
I think it's a testament
don't
to how effective accessibility has become through streaming, right? There's a reason that YouTube and Spotify have been so strong in that game is because it's accessible in those countries. I mean, I think, not that I was practicing law at the time, but even, before I was practicing, as far as I could tell, Latin music was huge as far as touring goes. Maybe not necessarily the same, when it comes to record sales, but as far as touring, I mean, Latin, Jenny Rivera would sell out shows here in the U.S. all the time.
Had Julio Iglesias. I don't know if
Julio
you
Iglesias, Juan Luis Guerra, who we also represent. These are huge named artists who, were selling out shows, right? So the industry has always been big. I mean, you remember there's a large amount of the world that speaks Spanish, and so they consume this music. And I think it's really the advent of streaming services, streaming platforms, and the
Because
accessibility to those territories that have led to the growth as far as record industry goes.
dare I say that it's also a lessening of the power of the major label? Because, remember, the Beatles couldn't get arrested because they were some English band. Who cared about them? It took a long time for them to finally get a deal with Capitol over here. And so and that's an English-speaking band, but not a U.S. band. So there was sort of very heavy control over who's going to become a big international star and who isn't. And streaming, I think, as you're saying, has sort of changed the power dynamic. And it's not like the labels that are calling all the shots, or other social media is dictating in a way the way that the record company's used to what's going to be acceptable. And maybe that, to your point, I think that might be part of what's going on. What do you think?
And I also think it's about the music, right? I mean, it's again, they like Bad Bunny made was able to do it through the music. I don't think it was necessarily because of the fact that it was in Spanish. I think it was in spite of being in Spanish. I think it's just kind of how that, reggaeton has kind of flown into and become in a way mainstream in the US, and that has changed. And that I think it's also happening with Mexican regional music as well. It's also becoming mainstream, and something that was extremely folk and that it was very, very niche music is now going into mainstream. And you can see, like, in the, I don't know, top Billboard, it like regional music is incredible. That's another phenomenon that I nobody would have expected again probably 10 years ago as well.
In the US, pretty much without fail, you're going to find anything that's on the top 10 is going to get sued for copyright infringement, pretty much. And I would get calls, as every lawyer would, from people who've claimed that that song was just like, is a ripoff of mine because it uses a hi-hat cymbal and, it's got people crowd noise in the back or whatever. And or it's a very generic type of a progression, and I, musical progression, and being a musician myself, and I just don't take those cases unless it's very specific. To me, it's a case that's really quite specific. But you've got just a deluge of copyright infringement cases. Maybe not as many since our friend Peter Anderson won the that Stairway to Heaven case and kind of stemmed the tide after the Blurred Lines disaster caused just an onslaught of these copyright frivolous, to my mind, copyright cases. But you've got a ton of copyright infringement litigation here. What about in Latin America? Are we seeing the same thing there, to your knowledge? Just sort of a feeding frenzy on these copyright infringement cases?
I would just say that in general, there's a lot less incentive in Latin America to sue because obviously there's less potential to recover. Like the damages are very limited. And in addition to that, it takes forever, takes years and years and years. So there's just less incentives for attorneys to just kind of take it on a contingent basis or kind of follow through. And so I think that's a big deterrent in terms of copyright infringement.
One question too is whether there's contingent fee agreements. I mean, like in the UK, there's very rarely do they allow that they allow it, but it's very regulated. But they have success fees where you don't have to pay the lawyer unless you win, but it's based on hours and stuff. But here you can just in the US do a contingent fee based on, a split, one third, two thirds, 40, 60, whatever. And that really juices up the amount of these cases. So in Latin America, do they just have straight split deals to your knowledge? Or is it more like success fee type of deals? And do you know whether that's yeah.
Yeah, I think both, but at the same time, I think there are less attorneys interested in moving through a contingent fee scenario because what I was saying, the potential
Right.
for recovery is substantially lower, and it's just gonna take too much time. So yeah, I think there's just a lot less incentive to do it. I'm not saying there isn't, and there probably is still, some litigation, but it's definitely like the litigation culture in Latin America is very different because of that.
Different. Yeah. And then you have the rule, like if it's a contract dispute or royalty dispute or whatever, if it's you have the who gets the attorney fees. So in the US, there's the English rule and the American rule. The American rule is if it's a contract dispute, it's got to be in the contract basically that says that the winning prevailing party in litigation gets their legal fees, or may get their legal fees or must, but if it's not in the contract, you ain't gonna get it. And in the English rule, you're gonna get it. You're entitled to your attorney's fees, whether it's written in the contract or not. I suspect that in much of Latin America, they have the English rule, which is that the winning party gets their attorney's fees, but I'm not sure about that. Anybody help me on that one?
Yeah, I think that's the general rule. I won't say that's the case in every country. I'm not sure, but yeah, at least in Colombia and in other Mexico and other countries, I know that's the case. Although it may not necessarily be, the total fees, but it's just kind of a what's called costas legales, like legal costs, and it's kind of sometimes it's capped, sometimes it's kind of determined by the judge. So it's not like you're even gonna get the full entire legal fees, if even if you're the winner,
So
basically.
it's not like the Vegas casino for plaintiffs and copyright cases that we see here in the States and contract cases.
I would think that even from just a simpler standpoint, there's the matter of personal jurisdiction, right? When you're suing somebody for copyright infringement, who are you really going after? You're going after the record label and the publisher. I mean, they're based here largely when you're talking about revenues or royalties that are worth suing for. You're going after the US companies. And so there's just the whole, procedural matter of where do you even have personal jurisdiction to sue? I mean, it wouldn't be in Latin America. It'd probably be here in the States.
Right. That's a good point. And here in the United States, we do have termination rights. And there's a case that'll be in the show notes about a case called Corcovado Music v. Hollis Music. And termination rights essentially say no matter how bad a contract you entered into, you can terminate it, or your heirs can terminate it after a certain number of years. Basically, it's nuanced, but that's essentially what it says, no matter what you signed. And that's only for the US, and you're only terminating for the US, not the rest of the world, but the US is the biggest market. And so it's a very important thing. So you had this case called Corcovado Music v. Hollis Music. Bossa Nova fans will recognize Corcovado. It's a song by Antonio Carlos Jobim, and it was his heirs, and they were trying to get back. They had made a deal in Brazil, or he had made a deal, he's Brazilian, with a Brazilian company. The contract was in Portuguese. It had a choice of law for Portuguese law. It had a venue clause, choice of forum for Brazil. Everything was Brazil. And so, yet they tried to terminate under U.S. law for the U.S. territory, brought a case in the Southern District of New York, and they lost because the Southern District said, well, there's no connection with the U.S., it's too Brazilian. Got reversed on by the Second Circuit. And the Second Circuit said, no matter what the contract said and the circumstances, U.S. copyright law is going to apply here. So the Jobim heirs got a reversion in the U.S. of all those great Bossa Nova tunes. And this is something that a lot of people have their eye on. And you know, if they're from outside, and particularly in Latin America, and say, gee, maybe we can terminate in the U.S., even if it's a completely Chilean or Venezuelan, I don't know, whatever, or Colombian contract or Mexican contract or what have you, that it could be terminated possibly in the US, which can be very financially rewarding if you win that. You know, so do you have any comment on that? This is something that, you know, for our CLE, we will have that case note. We'll have the actual case for you, and we can talk a bit about it. You know, these termination rights, I don't think they exist in Latin America. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think there is that, to my knowledge, termination rights.
I don't believe that's the case, at least in the same terms as we have here in the US.
You know, the couple points I'm going to make, it's not specifically the point about whether or not, you know, termination rights apply to transfers in other from other jurisdictions, but and this isn't uniquely Latin music either. There's a case called Fahmy versus Jay-Z that happened a few years ago, and it hit the Ninth Circuit in 2018. I got to see it firsthand because I was in law school and I sat in on the trial. But the case was whether or not a rights holder in Egypt who had acquired the rights to the copyright by way of descendancy can exercise their moral rights on the song Big Pimpin' and demand royalties be paid, right? And so
Well,
when you
let's just break down for real fast what moral rights is. I mean, it's basically we don't have it in the US, but
well
it's isn't
so
it saying that you can't change my song no matter what? You can't change it in a way that I don't approve of, or you can't like diminish it somehow?
yeah, I mean it's the right what the rights to attribution, you know, the right for you not to disparage the work or destroy the work, things along that nature. But what was being sought here was royalties based on a
Okay.
sample that was included on the song Big Pimpin', right? And so they were using a uniquely foreign concept of moral rights to acquire a royalty right, based on a license agreement. They basically tried to use the moral rights to terminate the license agreement and demand a royalty be paid. And if I recall correctly, the Central District of California said we don't have standing to rule on that issue. And so they kicked the case out. But it's something to think about when you talk about the bundle of rights that come with moral rights. The right to a royalty is not one of them, right?
Yeah.
That's that, and so It's a totally different concept. So exercising moral rights to try and demand that you get a royalty, it's not something that you can, that works well within the legal, system in the US. And so what I've seen is that, at least in the Ninth Circuit, they won't even address that question. The separate thing that I'm kind of curious of, and this is really because of the case regarding John Waite, where, he was prohibited from exercising a termination right because of work for hire provision, right? And so we have this, we're
Well,
constantly.
that's basically saying that, yeah, if you don't you don't have a termination right, if you agreed that it was a work for hire, that the company owned the copyright as the quote unquote author.
Correct. So what happens then when you have an artist that furnishes their services through a lender? Right, it's their own company. Technically, that would be a work for hire for your own lender, right? I mean, have you then alienated your termination rights by furnishing your services through the lender? And what happens if that lender isn't a U.S. company, but it was formed in a foreign jurisdiction like Colombia, right? I don't know. I don't know enough about Colombian law to know whether or not the work for hire concept is this, but I also don't know how termination rights would apply or be alienated in that situation where the lending company
Yeah,
is formed outside of the US.
some are trying to come up with these hybrid agreements, lender agreements between the artist and their loan out company, that called a lender loan out company, that sort of walks the tightrope between those and sort of says that nothing here will impact my right as an author to termination rights. But we've never litigated that, and we will see what happens there.
Right.
Very interesting.
Now, and talking about what you were mentioning on moral rights. So first of all, there is the concept of work for hire is included in a few Latin American legislations. However, it's different. It doesn't necessarily mean that the author is still the author. The author will still retain moral rights. It's just the construct of basically an initial ab initio assignment of the economic rights, basically. But it's there. It's conceptually is a defined concept, but it doesn't entail the same consequences as in the US. But you were mentioning that moral rights in order to get royalties. That's very interesting because I was literally just listening today about a claim that artists are doing in Colombia. So it's basically a label that owns all rights to certain masters, right? And they basically have those on the platforms, and they own the name of the band and everything. But then the performers are saying, hey, we should be named as performers in as a featured artist there, and as such we should be entitled to receive at least some royalties from that
Oh, right,
performance.
because it would be through their credit as a performer.
Correct, through their
I see.
credit. So
I see.
that's another interesting wrinkle that may come into play at some
Yeah.
point.
Wow. Well, any other closing thoughts, guys? Any other points that we didn't touch on that you might want to bring up? It's a big area. So I think this has been a great conversation, and let's just say muchísimas gracias, un plaisir, and soy gringo, but I love Latin music. Thank you guys so very much.